Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
How many times have you heard the term entrepreneurial government, or that government functionaries should act like entrepreneurs? My next guest asks, what does that even mean? Longtime Federal Union President and Leadership Professor Bob Tobias joins me now. And Bob, I get the sense you feel that term is a little annoying to try to think that government can somehow act like, I don't know, Silicon Valley. And I've heard it many times, and I never quite knew what the heck they're talking about either.
Well, Tom, we are, as you suggest, once again hearing private sector leaders criticizing federal career leaders for failing to be entrepreneurs. And the assumption is, be like us, be brave like us, and the public will be better served. I think the implication is that federal sector leaders are risk-averse bureaucrats unwilling to take any kind of an entrepreneurial risk of being creative. But I think that's just wrong. It's disparaging and wrong, because entrepreneurship is totally different in the federal sector. You know, we have this thing called the Constitution, and we have this thing called checks and balances. So it's really not possible to practice private sector entrepreneurship in the federal sector.
I think often what they mean is, you know, well, try to find better ways to do things. But, you know, government functionaries, government managers can't really do new things. They have to do things that they're empowered by law and statute to do according to the policies that they're given. And they can find more efficient ways to do that and more innovative ways to do that, but they can't do something different the way entrepreneurs can.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if Elon Musk wants to redesign a Tesla, he does.
I wish he would. They're getting kind of stale looking, you know, have the same car for 12 years or whatever.
You know, if he sells more cars, you know, Tesla's banks and the stockholders and Elon are very, very happy. And if he doesn't, they're unhappy. But the hallmark of federal sector leadership entrepreneurship is just the opposite. It's creativity in an environment where there's no agreement on government purpose, goals, or how to measure success. And as our Constitution requires, there's significant limitation on the freedom to design and implement proposals. So, you know, if you're a federal sector leader and you have this brilliant suggestion on how to collect more money from people who don't pay taxes or any other issue, you have to first get approval from your agency, then from the department, then from OMB, then from the president, and finally from Congress. Only the creative and persistent need apply. Again, just the opposite of the private sector flexibility. And oftentimes in the federal sector, reaching agreement is impossible because there's no agreement that a problem actually exists. So, for example, NOAA last year pointed out that there was $165 billion lost in 2023 to climate change issues. So federal sector leaders made proposals to mitigate climate change, and they went nowhere or not very far, because some people in Congress believe that the earth will heal itself, so there's no problem and no solutions are required. Or consider the IRS. Everybody agrees that government debt is an issue and should be reduced. So Congress agreed and said, well, we're going to give the IRS $80 billion over 10 years to increase audits on those who make $400,000 or more. So the IRS started conducting more audits and on average got $2 for every dollar invested and $6 for every dollar invested on those who were audited in the top 1% of wealth in the country. Now, I would say, Tom, that's an entrepreneurial jackpot. Anybody who gets $2 back for a dollar invested or $6 back for a dollar invested, that's pretty good. But Congress decided to reduce the amount from $80 billion to $60 billion.
We're speaking with Bob Tobias, former American University professor and NTEU president. But that's not really entrepreneurship. That's Congress deciding on a tax policy and a government agency operational policy that they believe would produce something. But it wasn't up to the IRS to institute that policy.
Correct. That's exactly the point, Tom. If you're in the private sector, nobody would come along and say, well, the policy needs to be changed. They would only say, hey, IRS, you made more money. We're going to give you more money to collect. That is precisely the point. In the private sector, it's money. In the public sector, in the federal sector, it's policy. So calling on people to behave as though money matters is just wrong.
Well, the other thing about Silicon Valley is that it purports, anyway, to admire people that are serial losers, even, because eventually you'll hit the jackpot. And what you don't hear as much for every Silicon Valley success story is how much money went down the drain and produced nothing for the investors. But the difference is that's the investors' money, and the public isn't harmed as it is when the government wastes money.
Well, you know, failure oftentimes leads to great learning and new innovation. But there's no room for failure, as you suggest, in the public sector. If there is failure, then there are congressional inquiries, the inspector general reports, GAO reports. So there's no opportunity to learn, which, again, is one more difference between the federal sector and the private sector. You know, notwithstanding all of these problems and limitations I've been mentioning, there are huge successes, as the Partnership for Public Service points out every single year with its SAMMY Awards. I mean, this last year, there was an award for an HHS team that made some significant progress on opioid death reduction, or the NASA team that proved they could send a rocket to an asteroid and move its course so it wouldn't crash into the Earth. Or the FBI team that collaborated all across the world to arrest on a single day 1,000 drug traffickers. Now, these are significant successes. But it's not the fault of the career federal employees that agency government purpose is unclear and often shifting, or that goals are hard to measure, or funding linked to goal achievement doesn't often exist. So the Constitution didn't create the executive branch to be a business. And I think that glib criticism that it should be run like a business should cease.
Right. So maybe a better approach, a better language approach, whatever you want to call it, is, yes, you should have, and I don't like the word bureaucrat, but you should have federal managers be innovative in how they carry out the programs and policies, but you can't ask them to innovate on policy and programs to begin with. That's really not the job of the standing civil service.
That is correct, Tom. There is always room for increased efficiency, increased effectiveness, and offering policy solutions, but it's not the responsibility of those federal employees to implement those policy solutions. That's not part of being an entrepreneur in the federal government.
Former American University professor and NTEU president Bob Tobias, as always, appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's a pleasure to see you.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency, and I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.